Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Supreme Court has started its new term shorthanded and split. After Justice Antonin Scalia died suddenly last winter, the Republican-controlled Senate refused to consider President Obama's nomination of Judge Merrick Garland. We're talking about what a Donald Trump or a Hillary Clinton presidency could mean for the high court in the new year and in the future in general. Joining us by phone from the Los Angeles Times Washington, D.C. Bureau, longtime U.S. Supreme Court correspondent David Savage. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann.
In 1968, Senate conservatives filibustered President Lyndon Johnson's choice to replace retiring Judge Chief Justice Earl Warren. What's the difference between what they did in 1968 and what has occurred since the death of Justice Scalia?
Well, not too much. I mean, in the spring of 1968, Warren said he was going to quit. Lyndon Johnson wanted to elevate Abe Fortas, and the Senate said, no, we're not going to allow a vote on Fortas. We're going to kick this over to the next president. And so in that sense, it's fairly similar. As you know, Mitch McConnell basically said, we're not going to allow President Obama to fill this seat. He's going out of office. We're going to wait till the next president. So in that sense, it's the first time since then in all those years, whatever it is, 45, nearly 50 years, that there's been essentially a vacancy on the Supreme Court that depends on the outcome of the presidential election.
And was it a different time of year? You know, Justice Scalia died in February, early February, actually. And what about the timing of the 68 case?
Well, you know, partisans could argue it either way.
Okay.
You know, Justice Scalia died in February, and you could say, okay, President Obama's got to whatever it is, 10 more months or 11 months. That Johnson came a little bit later, but it was essentially the same idea that the president made a nomination of a fully qualified nominee to fill the seat, and the Senate said, no, we're not going to allow a vote. We're going to wait.
What are expectations if Hillary Clinton wins that the Senate will approve Judge Garland during the lame duck session after the election?
Well, that's a great guessing game, and there are two different views of that, which is that if Hillary Clinton wins 2 weeks from now, wins solidly, and particularly if the Democrats take control of the Senate, that the Republicans, Orrin Hatch has basically said this, the Republicans are going to say to themselves, gee, we'd actually be much better off with allowing Merrick Garland to be confirmed in this lame duck session, in other words, in November or December. So a fair number of people think, even though the Republicans have said, no, no, we're going to wait for the next president, they'll actually change their mind in November because they might fear that Hillary Clinton might pick someone more liberal. The other view is that Mitch McConnell has pretty much dug in and said the next president will decide, and McConnell has sort of told people, no, no, I want to wait until January. So I've heard it argued either way, and I don't think nobody knows.
Hedging their bets or not. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of the United States Supreme Court today. My guest, David Savage, he's a Washington Bureau, from the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. He has been covering the Supreme Court for many years. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This guessing game, I guess you already have answered my next question about what the expectations are that Clinton, if elected, will nominate someone considered more liberal. That kind of depends on whether Democrats take control of the Senate, which, of course, is the body entrusted to confirm or deny a nomination.
Yes, that's right. And by the way, since we're just speculating here, I'll tell you my belief is that she actually will say to the senators, I like Merrick Garland. You should go ahead and confirm him. Merrick Garland served in the Clinton and her husband's administration. He's a very well-regarded judge. There are people on Clinton's staff who know Garland and speak very well of him, like former law clerks. And I also think the incoming president, Hillary Clinton, is going to have a heck of a lot of big problems to deal with, including picking an entire cabinet. She's got 1,000 problems facing her after the November election. And she's, I think, a pretty smart, wise person on this. And a lot of people I know who know her are going to say she's going to decide the smartest, best thing is just to go ahead and say yes to Merrick Garland. That'll push the Senate to do it. She'll fill that Supreme Court seat with a very well-qualified Democratic, sort of moderate liberal judge, and move on. And my bet, if I had to bet, that I think that's what she'll do.
What are expectations that there will be more vacancies in the near future? Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 83, Justice Anthony Kennedy, 80, and Justice Stephen Breyer, 78. No spring chickens there.
Right. And I hate to sort of throw these back to you as questions, but, you know, it's sort of, we've been through this before, and it sort of depends. When you get two or three people who are 80 years old and you're heading into a four-year term, what would you pick? I mean, normally people say, oh, one or two of those justices is going to either step down or perhaps have, you know, to die suddenly or have some illness. Mm-hmm. We thought for a long time Ruth Ginsburg was going to retire when President Obama was in office. She'd basically said that. She said she wanted to serve till she was 82. That's when Louis Brandeis stepped down. And then she changed her mind. I used to go to lunch once or twice a year with Chief Justice Rehnquist. He was a great guy to have lunch with, and he was always fun to talk with. When he first became Chief Justice, he would talk about getting into his 70s and stepping down and having time to retire and travel with his wife. Each year, as the years went on, retirement became less appealing. His wife got sick. She died. He would say, you know, who wants to travel by yourself? And he ended up dying in office. So I've sort of no longer make predictions as to when the justices are going to step down, because a lot of times you think, well, this person's 80 or 82 years, surely. But who knows?
Donald Trump has released a list of potential nominees if he is elected president. What has that list told you about his intentions? We know it's more conservative.
Well, the first thing I'd say about the list is I bet if he were asked at the debate, tell me something about one or two of those 20 nominees, he couldn't have done it. Hmm. That is, he didn't know these people. Hmm. This was done by the Heritage Foundation. They are the one notable thing about them. They are qualified judges with good conservative records, but none of them are from Washington. We've sort of gotten used to the idea that the U.S. Court of Appeals here is like a stepping stone for Supreme Court justices. So the one thing that I thought was interesting about this, it was an all non-Washington list. They were from judges around the country, some from Ohio, and they were, I think most people think, qualified conservative, but not necessarily national superstars, not known by everybody as saying this person is a likely next Supreme Court nominee.
I guess another interesting possibility is that Donald Trump is elected president and Democrats take over the Senate, huh?
Well, let me see.
Unlikely that would happen.
That's an unlikely combination. The Democrats would still have, you know, high 40s votes. But my understanding is on the political side of this is the only way the Democrats end up taking enough of the Senate seats is if there's a big vote for Hillary Clinton or a big vote against Donald Trump. And that, you know, turns the seats in North Carolina, or some of the states where it's very close. You know, if Donald Trump is elected, there's going to be a lot of interesting surprises. I don't think he either knows much or cares much about the specifics of the Supreme Court. I assume if he were elected, he would turn it over to a conservative, you know, attorney general, Chris Christie or whatever, and that person would be really in charge of picking Supreme Court nominees. That's what Ronald Reagan, for example. Reagan was interested in having conservative judges, but he didn't really know a lot of them. So mm-hmm. it was really up to Ed Meese or somebody in the Justice Department to do the picking.
Just is a recess appointment by President Obama, is that out of the question?
I think that would be viewed as a bad idea. The Supreme Court struck down some recess appointments a couple years ago, sort of crimped the president's power to do this. This is a long, complicated thing, but it's a question of what counts as a recess. Mm-hmm. And over time, presidents were more inclined to say, oh, the Senate's off for a couple weeks, they're on recess. And then the Senate kept holding these pro forma sessions, and they'd say, no, we're not on recess. And the Supreme Court basically agreed with the Senate that we're not going to allow the president to decide when the Senate's on recess. So the short answer to your question is no. I think that's pretty unlikely.
You've reported that there. Well, let's go to what some you've written about short term and longer term potential victories for liberals in terms of cases that would go before the court should Hillary Clinton win the election. Short term, what are we looking at?
I think the big short-term issue is a leftover from President Obama, which is things like immigration, climate change, and, say, rights for transgender students. In all those areas, what the last 8 years has been like. President Obama has wanted to do things, and the Republican-controlled Senate is saying, no, we're not going to consider that. So President Obama has this immigration order that he would like to put into force to say that if you're a parent who has a legal child in the United States, you're here an undocumented immigrant, you've lived here for 5 or 10 years, you've worked, you've got a good record, you can come forward, apply, go through a background check, get a work permit. And there's something like 5 million people in that category. President Obama said, the current immigration laws allow me to do this. Texas and a bunch of conservative states went to court and said, no, the immigration laws don't allow you to do that. The Obama's order was put on hold. It came to the Supreme Court. They split 4-4. If Merrick Garland takes the ninth seat, I think the likelihood is that case will come back. It's still pending in the lower courts. And the Supreme Court will say, yes, the immigration laws allows President Obama or new President Clinton to do this. Climate change, very similar. Congress wouldn't do anything on climate change. President Obama issued a very big order that affects the power plants around the country. Basically says if you're in Ohio or Michigan or whatever, over time you need to move to cleaner fuels, natural gas, phase out coal. A lot of the states are fighting that. And the Supreme Court put it on hold before Scalia died. I think if, again, Merrick Garland takes over, that climate change policy, which is a big deal on the environmental front, goes forward. And this week, on Friday, the court meets on to discuss again whether to take up an issue of high school students, transgender rights, a student from Virginia. The Obama administration said denying students, transgender students, the right to use restrooms or locker rooms based on their gender identity is sex discrimination. Again, Texas went to court, won an order out from a judge in Texas saying, no, the old federal anti-discrimination laws don't cover this at all. The Obama administration can't enforce this. The Supreme Court may on Friday or early next week or may sit on it for another month. They've got to resolve that dispute as to what the sex discrimination laws allow or don't allow, whether they cover this issue. So those are three of the kinds of pending issues that I think could be resolved relatively quickly. In other words, by next summer or, soon after, if Merrick Garland takes over.
We're talking about the future of the United States Supreme Court, given the upcoming presidential election. My guest, David Savage, Washington. He was a Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times in the Washington Bureau. Coming up, we're going to have a OSU law professor join us, and also Dahlia Lithwick, court reporter for Slate and host of the podcast Amicus. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The U.S. Supreme Court began its 2016 term earlier this month, shorthanded and evenly split. Following the unexpected death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia last winter, Republican senators have vowed to ignore any nominee put forth by President Obama until after Election Day. That could mean a lame duck decision on Garland. It could be a longer wait. I should say Merrick Garland, the president's nominee. Either way, the nation's highest court could undergo a historic ideological transformation. A Hillary Clinton presidency would mean the first liberal majority in a half century. A Donald Trump victory would solidify a conservative bench that could reverse earlier decisions on abortion rights and affirmative action. Still with us is Los Angeles Times Supreme Court correspondent David Savage. Also joining us in the studio, Ohio State University constitutional law professor Mark Spendelman. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And by phone, senior court reporter for Slate and host of the podcast Amicus, Dahlia Lithwick. Welcome to the show, Dahlia.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Last week, Arizona Senator John McCain told a Philadelphia talk radio audience that Republicans would block any Supreme Court nominee made if Hillary Clinton is elected on November 8th.
I promise you that we will be united against any Supreme Court nominee that that Hillary Clinton, if she were president, would
okay.
put up. And I promise you, this is.
And he went on. McCain's spokesperson has since walked back some of those remarks, but the issues remain how or if the Senate embraces a Clinton nominee if she's elected. Dahlia Lithwick, you called it a gaffe that probably wasn't really a gaffe. Why that?
Well, it's important to understand the context. He was in Pennsylvania campaigning for Pat Toomey, who's in a tight Senate race. And what he's saying is, look, we're going to lose the presidency. Let's keep the Senate. This is the only bulwark we have against Hillary judges. And this has been, I'd say it's not a gaffe, because this has certainly been the message we've been hearing from Senate Republicans, whether they're embattled by, you know, the obstruction of Garland. Some of them are openly campaigning on the obstruction of Garland. So this is of a piece with what we've heard over the summer, which is we cannot afford to lose the Senate majority, because otherwise we're going to see Hillary judges for the next 4 years. And so I think he made a process error. In other words, I think what he was saying was, we're going to block all Hillary judges, and it sounded as though he was saying, we're not even going to give them hearings. When his campaign walked it back, and by the way, it wasn't him that walked it back, it was his
right.
Spokesperson, they said, oh, no, we'll vet them, they'll be vetted. So they're saying, well, we may give them hearings and just vote no. But the substance of the argument, if you put aside the fight about whether folks are going to get hearings going forward, is very much of a piece with this idea that if we lose the presidency, the only thing left for Republicans in the Senate is to have a majority and to block everyone. And whether that's by denying even hearings like we have now, or by simply having hearings and voting no, that's a very, very significant difference from anything we've heard before.
You've reported that there isn't much unity in the Senate to unite to block any Clinton nominee, though.
Well, you know, almost immediately we heard Jeff Flake peel off from, you know, that McCain stance. We've heard, you know, Kelly Ayotte, another embattled senator in New Hampshire, is very much of the view, I think, that, you know, we can't take the position that we're going to, you know, fold our arms and do nothing for 4 years. I'm going to lose. And so what we've seen, and in that sense it's kind of interesting, is a split between the McCain posture, which is nobody, never for 4 years, and folks like Jeff Flake or Kelly Ayotte, or even I think Chuck Grassley, who has said, oh, of course, you know, we're not going to slow walk this forever. If Hillary gets elected, we're going to have to do something. Again, whether doing something means seating nominees or whether it means giving them hearings and voting no is still in question. But I do think you're right that it reveals that there's sort of an array of public positions around this idea that, you know, we are overtly campaigning on no Hillary nominee ever, as opposed to we have to, you know, fix the system and let's figure out just how obstructive we can be without losing our jobs.
Well, okay, exactly. So, Mark Spendelman, how obstructive can they be without losing their jobs?
Well, as obstructive as the American people will let them be, okay. Which I think is not all that obstructive in the longer term. It seems likely that once there are hearings, if there are hearings, the American people will be able to begin to judge for themselves the reasonableness, the sobriety, the demeanor of the judges who the president is putting forward. And I think this is part of the reason why there haven't been broad hearings around Judge Garland. Once the American people see the qualifications, which members of the Senate have themselves recognized, it's hard to keep on saying no. So once the process gets going and the train takes off, leaves the station like that, it seems like it's going to be hard to sort of get it to stop dead in its tracks.
Is there any sense, David Savage, about how damaging this tack by Senate Republican leadership has been to their caucus, to their party?
Well, I don't
if at all, or if not, not damaging at all, I should say.
Yes, I was going to say, if you mean this year, it doesn't seem like it's done them any damage. This is one of these things. I remember back in the Clinton impeachment. Ron Brownstein always would say, you know, that's, you need to think of Republican logic versus Democratic logic. A lot of people might say, gee, it's a bad thing not to allow a vote on the Supreme Court justice. But if you ask Republican voters, they'd say, we're all in favor of that. You know, hold the line. Don't go forward. So I don't think it's done them any damage. I don't think it's done the Republican senators any damage with Republican voters. I do agree with the sense of what Dahlia is saying. We're in a really bad new world if after January the Republicans take the view, if they have, let's say, 51 votes in the Senate, mm-hmm. and say, we are going to block all President Hillary Clinton's qualified judicial nominees because that's about the only authority we have. And we're just going to block them. Then we're in a really bad situation.
And do you think they're on thin ice with their base then?
I guess we will see.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of the Supreme Court. You just heard from David Savage. He is a Supreme Court reporter for the LA Times in Washington. And also with us, Dahlia Lithwick, court reporter for Slate and host of Amicus, the podcast Amicus. And with me in the studio, Mark Spindleman. He's an OSU constitutional law professor. Questions or comments, give us a call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Carl in Medina, you're on the air. Hi, Carl.
Hi. You know, speaking of damage, let's remember the Latin injuria abscue damum, which means wrong without damage, which is an indication that there can be no lawsuit where there are no damages, even though a wrong may have been committed. You know, we're polarized this day and age by the deviation in the norm. You know, psychology would say 2 points either way is abnormal. You know, we have a polarized judiciary sometimes, when, especially if you think of, you know, you brought up the transgender issue. Mm-hmm. And think about, we're at war, and then think about generational warfare. You know, it's going to harm children in this day and age to, you know, over the years, they think certain things may be okay, even though the moral compass really says that that's not like the divine plan, you know, and we're getting so polarized. I would think that we need to make sure that the preamble of the Constitution is met by our judiciary as well, seeking that we form a more perfect union and not have this polarized sense of entitlement from these people that have different agendas. You know, we are supposed to be together as a country, and it seems like we're being more diverse.
Oops, sorry, Carl, I didn't mean to cut you off like that, but historically, Mark Spindleman, there have been divided courts before.
There have been divided courts and divided country. I do think that Carl's question in part goes to a sense, if I was understanding it correctly and the observations he was making correctly, goes to a sense of real sort of conflict, both in politics across the country, that's having an effect on the structure and the daily business of the Supreme Court. And the significance of this next appointment can't be underscored enough, I think, for many people. And it reflects a kind of sense of what the possibilities are of the election, not only for the next 4 or maybe 8 years, but for a considerable period into the future. And what the role of the court should be in sort of mending some of these divisions that exist in the country.
Yeah. Dahlia Lithwick, what's the process for the remainder of the current Supreme Court session if the Garland nomination is approved by the Senate after the election? Does he jump in and get to it, or does he have to wait until the next session?
No, he can jump in, but I think, you know, the very earliest we're thinking that could happen, you know, whether there's a lame duck confirmation or something in early January, at the very earliest, he jumps in right toward the end of the term. I mean, the court stops hearing oral arguments in April. So, you know, it presumably he could, you know, be on the court in March and hear a couple of cases.
Okay.
But it's important to understand the court is, I think David made this point, right now they are deciding which cases they are going to hear going on into the winter. And so, you know, there's some lag time there, and the court is most decisively taking off the table any cases that look like they might split 4-4. So it's possible that what the court is doing right now in order to protect itself from having 4-4 splits in controversial cases may affect the entire rest of the term.
And then getting to the issue that the caller brought up, the polarization, what sense, and I'm interested in Dahlia and also David Savage, what sense does the court have about its role in bringing the country together necessarily?
Well, it's, you know, it's such a great question. I think in a sense it's the question, because a lot of folks ask me, why didn't John Roberts just get up the day Scalia died or the day that Obama tapped Merrick Garland and make a speech saying, you know, we need 9 justices. You know, why didn't somebody after the court split 4-4 in several cases, including the important immigration case David talked about, why didn't someone get up and say, hey, we need 9 justices. We can't do this for the long term. And we've heard almost resounding silence from the institution. In fact, Justice Breyer only just this week again reiterated, we're fine, we can do this forever. And that's because institutionally, they don't want to be in this fight.
Yeah.
The worst thing they can do as a court that is trying to transcend what Carl's describing, you know, the view of a partisan bickering ours versus D court, is to be silent. And so as a consequence, what we're seeing is institutionally the court's tremendous interest in being above all that. And what that means is that the court itself, although I think it's struggling and will continue to struggle, says very little. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has made some comments, but institutionally it behooves them to stay out of the fray.
But they are shorthanded, right, David Savage? I mean,
well, they sure are.
Yeah.
And let me put in a plug for Merrick Garland as the sort of strikes me as he's a very wise choice on President Obama's part. I know Garland a little bit. I've known him over a number of years. And he's been on the Court of Appeals in Washington for a lot of years that had a very strong conservative majority. And Garland would always say to you, if you did sort of talk to him, he'd say, you know, people would ask him, how do you get along on this court? And he said, well, you know, if you go into a conference and sit down with a couple colleagues and look at a case and say, what can we agree on? You can often find that if you have a friend or, you know, somebody you have to work with, if you go into something and say, well, you know, I come at it from this aspect and you come at it from that completely different, we really can't get along because we have different worldviews. You're probably not going to get along. But if you sit down and say, what do we agree on? You can actually find that a lot of times you agree on 80 or 90% of the matter. And so Garland became a judge who was very good at finding a way to decide cases where you decide most of it. You come to an agreement, and you can get, there'd be like 3 judges, 2 conservatives and 1 liberal, and they'd put out unanimous decisions. And so I think Merrick Garland is somebody who knows John Roberts. They were together on that court for a while. I think he's the sort of ideal person because He's a fairly moderate, maybe a little bit left to center, but he's not a hard-edged ideologue. And I actually think he's the kind of guy who could go on a court and they could find a way to decide a lot of cases where they really resolve the essential issue, but they don't do it in a way that's highly ideological and inflammatory.
And Anne, I might just add, because I think it's worth just tacking on to David's point, that we have a vast record from Merrick Garland. I mean, he has written, it's tough to find a memorable bomb-throwing sentence that he's written. I mean, this is not...
Right.
Somebody,
he's not going to make our job easier, Dahlia.
No. I mean, he is. It is hard to find a quotable line because he really is... exactly what David's saying. He's kind of a get-along guy who really, I think, strives for consensus. And one of the reasons you've heard so very little about him is because on the merits, there's not much to say about him that's disqualifying. I mean, he really is the opposite of the kind of bomb thrower that a lot of progressives wanted to see, right? They wanted to see another Thurgood Marshall. And I think that it really does become very complicated to oppose him on the merits. And so instead, we oppose him on these big institutional claims because on the merits, you know, he's 64. He's very much older than most judicial taps in this era. You know, he's highly qualified. And as David suggests, he really is somebody who is a consensus builder. And so instead, we have fights about who's appointing him.
So, I mean, all things being equal, do the so-called conservatives on the court necessarily want a bomb-throwing ideologue from the hinterlands to join the court, or would someone like Merrick Garland be possibly more preferable to them?
I think if you asked Joan Robertson, he could give you an honest answer. He'd say, he would very much rather have a Merrick Garland, because he knows on a whole lot of cases, even if they start out disagreeing, they can come to some agreement. They always say, oh, sure, there's a certain number of cases where you're going to disagree. But he would much rather have somebody like Merrick Garland, who's a smart, professional, good judge, rather than somebody who is, from Robert's point of view, a sort of a liberal ideologue who will fire off a series of angry dissents.
Or conversely, a conservative.
Well,
or not necessarily.
You know, I should amend that to say that if John Roberts were given another conservative voice, he'd rather have another conservative vote.
But that's what I was trying to get.
No. Would rather have. He'd rather have a conservative than a liberal. But if he had to have a Democratic appointee, mm-hmm. Merrick Garland is exactly what he would like.
Mm. We will continue our conversation about the future of the United States Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. You just heard from David Savage. He covers the Supreme Court, longtime reporter of the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. He's based in Washington. And also Dahlia Lithwick. She's a court reporter for Slate and host of the podcast Amicus. And with me in the studio, OSU Law Professor Mark Spendelman. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the next president could shape the ideological makeup of the United States Supreme Court. During the final presidential debate, Republican candidate Donald Trump promised to overturn landmark Roe v. Wade decision.
Do you want to see the court overturn? You just said you want to see the court protect the Second Amendment. Do you want to see the court overturn Roe v. Wade?
Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that's really what's going to be, that will happen. And that'll happen automatically, in my opinion, because I am putting pro-life justices on the court. I will say this, it will go back to the states, and the states will then make a determination.
Still with us, OSU Constitutional Law Professor Mark Spendelman, by phone from Washington, D.C., Los Angeles Times Supreme Court correspondent David Savage, and senior court reporter for Slate and host of the podcast Amicus, Dahlia Lithwick. Mark Spendelman, this idea that something will automatically happen on the court if there's three more conservatives on the court, if there's a Donald Trump presidency, is that the way it works?
Well, he's telling us he's going to appoint justices who are pro-life in their political worldview. He told us that he believes that justices should adhere to traditional modes of interpreting the Constitution. Between those two statements, combined in some particular way, he's telling us he's going to put justices on the court who will have in their sights the Supreme Court's decision in Roe against Wade and the subsequent cases that have been delivered by the Supreme Court respecting a woman's right to choose ever since.
So what happens then in that case? They're sending, you know, it's a shot across the bow. That means that groups out there, special interest groups out there, start ginning up lawsuits to make their way to the Supreme Court.
Well, there are legislatures all across the country, including Ohio's, that have enacted measures that seek to restrict a woman's right to choose. It's not inconceivable that those measures would be brought back online if they haven't already been struck down and cases would go up. The question would be the sequencing. Would it happen quickly and swiftly, or would Roe be cut back sort of piece by piece until it was time to administer the coup de grace?
David Savage, you mentioned earlier that a nominee like Merrick Garland would make your job harder because there's so little known about him. Conversely, does a nominee about which we know a lot, about which you know we understand their worldview on many issues, particularly these very, very controversial ones, does that make your job easier?
Well, it makes it easier in the sense that there's no mystery. Usually you'd think you're appointing a judge or a justice. That's a person to decide these issues. And the way we're going politically is we pick the justice because we know how he or she thinks about all the issues. In other words, we know in advance what. So, yes, it would be easier. But I was really referring to the fact that Justice Scalia was so much fun to cover for people like Dolly and me because he was such an outspoken, strong, you really sort of knew what he thought about everything. Mm-hmm. And Merrick Garland is more like one of the old-fashioned justices who's very sort of reserved and moderate and not very strong or blunt in what he says. He's more like a judge. Mm-hmm. And and so in that sense, Dolly and I could always, you know, we would go to the arguments and you could always count on Justice Scalia to say something that was a really pithy or funny or strong quote. He was an easy guy to, you know, use for a news story. And so he made our jobs easier in that sense.
Right. Right. We have a couple emails, one from Kristen, who writes, this whole Supreme Court gridlock does not seem very democratic in the way of people rule. I understand checks and balances, so Republican voters still have weight in the direction of the country if Hillary Clinton becomes president. However, I feel like Republicans are not doing their duty as politicians to work together to better this country. An email from Brad. He says, I think that people like Mitch McConnell will rue the day he took this stand on Judge Garland. I also think that after the election, Democrats in Congress should prevent the confirmation vote until the new president is in office and allow the new president, Hillary Clinton, that's parenthetically, to select her own nominee, who will likely be much more like Ginsburg or Sotomayor than Scalia. And you made the point earlier, David Savage, that she's got to have, if she's elected, she'll have a lot on her plate. She would be wise, and you think likely would stick with Garland.
Well, yes, that's my guess. Mm-hmm. And in response to that comment from the second person, I do think Mitch McConnell won't go forward until Hillary Clinton says, "I would like you, the Senate, to go ahead and approve President Obama's choice of Judge Garland." In other words, Hillary Clinton is going to have to say something. My guess is they wouldn't do it if she stays silent. She would have to affirmatively say, I think you should go ahead. So in that sense, she would be sort of, it would be sort of the new president making the decision.
Yeah. Yeah. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. Dahlia, Lithwick, we hear a lot that the prospect of a liberal court is driving many to support Donald Trump. Any sense about whether that's historically significant for the electorate to take that much interest at this point in the game?
Well, I think this really goes to there's been a huge disparity in, they call it the enthusiasm gap between Republican voters and Democrats for decades now on the issue of the court. And that just goes to how well I think Republicans have organized and messaged around the composition of the courts and that their voters really do put this on the top one or two list of their issues, in part because I think they've turned it into a conversation about guns, about abortion, about gay rights, which really mobilizes their base. So this has been a tremendous voting issue, and the GOP has really done a very, very good job in recent years and decades in getting voters to be willing to say, you know, listen, I hate Donald Trump, but I'm going to vote for him anyway because of the court. There is no analog to that on the left. I think progressives have just not done a good job of communicating that the composition of the court is sort of the straight line between whether you have environmental concerns or, you know, labor concerns or, women's rights, whatever it is. If you don't have the court behind you, you can only get so far. And certainly the travails of the Affordable Care Act is good evidence of, you know, how a court can all but thwart the progress of something that progressives wanted. And I simply think, it certainly goes back decades. Nixon ran on the composition of the court. It really has been interesting in some sense that despite the fact that, Republicans have kind of controlled the court for the last few decades, they haven't had the legal and constitutional outcomes that they wanted in all cases, you know, including same-sex marriage, including abortion, including affirmative action. And so I think there's a longstanding feeling that how is it possible that we keep winning elections, putting people on the courts, and still not getting the outcomes we want? And in that sense, I think it's really important to understand that what we are fighting about is Justice Scalia's seat, that this might have been a different conversation if this wasn't such an iconic justice. And it's not just that his seat is now vacant, but that a Democrat is going to replace him. I think, you know, this is just emblematic of the final injustice. And tagged to that, I would say it's important to understand that the reason the Republicans and they're not achieved on the court is because Anthony Kennedy is sitting in a seat that I think an awful lot of Republicans think should have gone to Robert Bork. And that is the original sin. If Anthony Kennedy didn't keep defecting on marriage equality and abortion and affirmative action, there would be a sense that, that was our seat. We filled it and we got what we wanted. Instead, they kind of got a waffle at the middle of the court. And I think that's very, very frustrating to Republicans.
Mark Spindleman?
I'm just sort of struck by Dahlia's insights. The one thing I would say is really by way of a footnote, I think it turns out it's pretty complex, but there's a certain kind of asymmetry between what the right wants and what the left progressive movements want and how the Supreme Court can deliver on some of those issues. So if you look at an issue like marriage equality or you look like at an issue like reproductive rights, it looks like the Supreme Court is a pretty powerful institution. They're ready to vindicate rights and to strike down laws that fail to respect either the right to marriage equality or the right to abortion, for instance. But when it comes to a whole range of issues on the left, labor, other kinds of progressive movements, environmental causes of action, the court can't deliver one-to-one in quite the simple way that it can deliver either in the context of marriage equality or reproductive rights, or can deliver on a whole range of conservative issues that are about small government. The Supreme Court has the power of nullification. It doesn't have the power of action.
To legislate.
It doesn't have the power to legislate, and the Constitution is structured in such a way that it's rare that the Supreme Court can compel action as an ordinary matter of constitutional right. It's a complicated question with lots of caveats, but that's the simple story.
Yeah. Going back to what Dahlia said about Judge Bork and that whole That was the one that first arose in my consciousness, David Savage, as one of the big conflicts, one of the things that hit the headlines and what made you sit up and go, oh, the Supreme Court, this matters, people care. Would that be your recollection, David Savage, or does it go back farther than that?
No, I absolutely agree with that. That was the real cataclysm. Was that summer when Lewis Powell, who had been the swing vote on the court, stepped down. And it was nearing the end of President Reagan's term. The conservatives were upset, sort of along the lines of what Dahlia said. We keep putting Republican appointees, but we haven't overturned Roe versus Wade. We haven't brought back prayer in schools. There was a series of things they really haven't overturned the Miranda warnings. Robert Bork is the guy who had made a name for himself as a Yale law professor, as a critic of the Warren Court. He wanted to overturn a series of things, including the various civil rights laws. Reagan nominated him. Joe Biden said, "Don't do it. If you pick Robert Bork, you've got a problem." And it turned out, you know, there was a summer-long fight, and Bork was voted down. And then, after the Doug Ginsburg sort of brief fiasco. Mm-hmm. President Reagan had known Tony Kennedy from Sacramento, and Justice Kennedy was a conservative but a California Republican, a moderate Republican on the sort of social issues, relatively conservative guy, but not a hard-edged ideologue, and he ended up winning a unanimous confirmation. And you could almost say everything in the 30 years since then has been sort of set based on that decision. Because the conservatives could only go as far as Anthony Kennedy would go, and he would not overturn Roe versus Wade. He would not throw out the Miranda warnings, and so that's sort of where we've been for 30 years.
So we only have a few minutes left, but David Savage, you mentioned some short-term issues that'll go before the court. Mark Spindleman, what about some longer-range trends? I mean, do you see the court having a sudden and sweeping change to how it reacts to issues or not?
I doubt it. Yeah. I think the expectation probably should be set in the direction of sort of, it's a big ship. And to turn the ship to the left is going to take a lot of work, and it will happen very slowly and incrementally. I do think that that Secretary Clinton has put a number of action items on the agenda for discussion. Citizens United is certainly one. I think that there are other cases that we can sort of think about in the longer term involving congressional powers, involving race equality, involving the death penalty, among other topics that seem likely to be sort of on the horizon and to be likely to be decided slowly or less slowly, depending on the cases. In a liberal direction, if Hillary Clinton is the next president.
Dahlia Lithwick?
I completely agree with Professor Spindleman. I think that it is unlikely you are going to see, just because, you know, progress at the court is glacial. And I think you asked the question, you know, can Trump or Hillary put someone up who immediately, you know, overturns mm-hmm. Citizens United and immediately overturns Roe? And of course, the answer is no. It takes years to position cases and to get to the point where your justice, assuming they do what you want them to do, gets there. So this is a very, very slow thing, and that's a good thing, because I think sort of undergirding everything we've said here today is that the court is not a purely political institution. They wear black robes for a reason. They deliberate for a reason. They have to show their work for a reason. This is not like the other branches of government, and the court is more invested in promoting that than any other institution.
Dahlia Lithwick, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick, court reporter for Slate, host of the podcast Amicus. Also, David Savage, Washington Bureau Supreme Court reporter for LA Times. David, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ann. Good to speak with you.
And Mark Spindleman, OSU law professor. Thanks for joining us as always.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.